And this is the only judge that comes from Judah. There are others that come from Ephraim, from Benjamin, but this is the only one from Judah. And he's the first one mentioned. And we find in a lot of these things, Judah has preeminence, is the first one. He had married, well, he had been given Caleb's daughter, Aksah, because he had taken the city Kiryat Sefer, which is city of books. I don't know, did he conquer the library? But that's what the name means. We have this pattern over and over again. Kushan Rishathaim was king of Mesopotamia. In some translations, it says Aram, or others say Aram Naharaim. It's all different names for Mesopotamia, for that region. There's not much that's said about the man himself, which in one sense is good. Many of the commentators talk about the various judges and they talk about what scoundrels they were in one form or another. You take Samson and his exploits. He did not seem to be, you know, the guy that you'd really want to say, son, look at this man and follow him because he's such a good example. Othniel, there's nothing. There's nothing bad. Now, he judged Israel. Well, one, it says the Spirit of the Lord came on him. In only a couple of cases is that sort of phrasing used. With Samson, with him, I forget which others, but it's rare. The very few that use that phrasing. Also, it says he judged Israel. The other two that we're going to look at today, it doesn't say anything. It's implied, but it doesn't say anything. I mean, it does not specifically say they were judges. When we get to Shamgar, he only gets one verse instead of three. Just thinking about it, it seems likely that Othniel had probably been established for some time as a leader. Because when he went out to war, you know, he's taken an army with him. So you don't follow just anybody. He was apparently a well-established leader, and he went out, the people followed him, and the Lord gave him victory. And then they had rest for 40 years, which is not a bad run. It'd be nice to have 40 years of peace. Especially considering all the stuff that's going on in that neighborhood. And then he died. What happens next? What always happens next? The people go back into sin. So he died. There was no judge in Israel. Israel did evil again. So we see the pattern repeating itself. So God strengthened Eglon, king of Moab. This is, you know, what do you mean? You're getting our enemies against us? Yes. Let's see. Daniel. Oops. Turned the page too soon. In Daniel 4:32, it says, this was Nebuchadnezzar saying, or it was said to him, you will be given grass to eat like cattle, and seven periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. He will raise up peoples and leaders to accomplish his will. And if his will is teaching Israel, guys, you need to toughen up and obey, that's fine. By him. So he was strengthened. Eglon allied himself with Ammon and Amalek. So there are these other two peoples around there. You had Moab down in the southeast, and Ammon was just to the north of that, and Amalek was somewhat to the west. Gets these three peoples together and goes and conquers Israel. It just says Israel. It doesn't say a particular area. It doesn't say a particular tribe. It's Israel. So we don't know, you know, how much of it was affected by it. There's no mention of things out of the far northern tribes like Asher and Naphtali, but it just says Israel. And then Israel was, it says, took the city of palm trees. What's the city of palm trees? Most scholars or people that are talking about this assume that it means Jericho. So here was the city that had been demolished, and they took the city, or at least the region. So Moab had come over the Jordan and had taken possession of some of the territory of Israel, and the rest of Israel was a vassal state. And they had to pay tribute because they'd been conquered. So let's take a little moment and go back and look at Jericho. In Joshua 6:26, after they had conquered and demolished Jericho, then Joshua made them take an oath at that time, saying, "Cursed be the man, or cursed before the Lord is the man who rises up and builds this city Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn, he shall lay its foundation, and with the loss of his youngest son, he shall set up its gates." The fulfillment of this curse happened in 1 Kings 16:28. In his days, Hiel, the Bethelite, built Jericho. He laid its foundations with the loss of Abiram, his firstborn, and set up its gates with the loss of his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which he had spoken by Joshua, the son of Nun. This happened in the time of Ahab. This is several hundred years later. So when they say, well, they took Jericho, and the implication is they set up shop in Jericho. I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, we really don't have anything more to go on. But probably within that area. Jericho is interesting. It's the lowest city in the world, about 850 feet below sea level, very close to the Dead Sea. There is a spring there that has a flow of 1,000 gallons a minute. For the civil engineers, that's 1.4 million gallons per day. That is enough for a small city. And the population there today is about 20,000. So they've got a city and some agricultural stuff right around it, apparently fed by this spring, and there may be others as well. But they have a water supply. If you don't like rain, it's a good place to be. They get about 8 inches of rain a year. But that's a little on Jericho. So all of Israel was a vassal state at this point. Ehud had conquered, and the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. They had been serving him for some years now, and Ehud was raised up as a deliverer. He was the son of Gera, a Benjamite. So here we have this second judge from the tribe of Benjamin. He was left-handed. The text says he was left-handed. Or, from the Hebrew, it doesn't say left-handed. It says something that gives the impression of shut off from his right hand. And many commentators make a big deal of this. And they say, well, he couldn't use his right hand. We don't know that. It says he was left-handed. Later on in Judges, let's see if I can, I think I have In Judges 20:16, it tells of 700 choice men of Benjamin, all left-handed, who could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. That doesn't sound like somebody you'd call disabled. It's just they happen to be left-handed. Now, most people were right-handed. And in certain cultures, even today, to use your left hand is an insult. If you were to offer somebody food, in much of the Middle East, if you were to offer somebody food with your left hand, that would be the height of an insult. You use your right hand for all sorts of things. The left hand's dirty. The right hand is for good stuff. Yes. Did you all hear that? She said she was working with Special Olympics in the food concessions, and they emphasized to the people working there, hand the food to the people with your right hand, because it was an international event, and to give them something with your left hand would be an insult. So you made sure that you handed everybody the food with your right hand. So being left-handed or using the left hand was not so much expected. But what this did was it gave him an advantage that he used. Now, Ehud made a sword a cubit long. How long is a cubit? Well, we usually say 18 inches. If it was my, you know, from the elbow to the fingertips, it'd be a little longer than that for me. But about a foot and a half. Actually, that length is about the same length as your thigh. So this is basically the longest sword that he could strap to his thigh and not have it stand out or be noticed. He bound it to his right thigh because if you're handling a sword, you know, you see the cavalry officers and all, the right-handed men have the sword to the left because you reach across and draw the sword. You don't pull it from the same side. It'd be very awkward. So being left-handed, he would take it from his right thigh. But now, when he goes into the king, and, you know, if they've got any kind of security, they're checking him out, and they would check for a sword or some kind of weapon on the left side. Well, they didn't check his right side, just assuming, apparently, that most people were right-handed. So he delivered the tribute. And then he started back, and they got as far as about Gilgal, and he sent the others on ahead, and he turned back there. Now, the name Gilgal means circle of stones. Some translations say he turned back from the idols. Some say the carved images, and about half the translations say the quarries. Which is interesting. I don't know if there are any quarries in that area, but at any rate, he turned back at about that point. Now, Gilgal is assumed to be somewhere pretty close to Jericho. You know, that was where the nation of Israel camped before they took Jericho. And he went back. He turned back from Gilgal, the others went ahead, and he went back to Eglon, the king. He had a secret message. He tells the king, I have a secret message for you. And the king falls right into it. He says, keep silence. And he sends everybody out because this secret message was only going to be heard by him. Then Ehud says, I have a message from God for you. And Eglon rises from his seat. What gets a king to stand up? You know, the kings are the ones who sit while everybody else stands. Was it out of respect for God because he said, I have a message from God? Or was he like a little kid that was just overcome with anticipation? I'm getting something special and couldn't sit down? I mean, we don't know. I can only speculate about things like this. But he got up, and who delivered the message? You know what the message was. He buried the sword in his gut and left it there. Well, when I was a kid, we ordered our clothes from the Sears catalog, and they referred to the larger people as husky. Eglon was a very husky guy, such that this sword went in lengthways and was completely buried. And then he locked the chamber, and he left. He escaped. And the king's minions, you know, they saw, oh, the door is locked. He's probably just relieving himself here. And they waited and waited and waited until, you know, they thought, hey, we better check this out. They went and they found him dead. Eglon escaped to Ra, and which we don't know where it really is. It's somewhere off in the hill country of Ephraim. And he blew the trumpet probably being the shofar, the ram's horn. Now, how does that get a lot of people? One, we didn't have jets flying over at the time, so you could hear something like this for miles. You know, the sound of one of these horns would carry for a long way. And although it's not stated, it's very likely that they had an organized system where if you hear the call for, you know, a distress call from over there, you blow it that direction and you spread the word. That could happen very quickly, basically slightly slower than the speed of sound. So within a few minutes, you could alert an area 20 miles in diameter easily. And then the people of Israel gathered to him. Do it again. And the sons of Israel went down with him. Here again, it's the sons of Israel, not specifically Ephraim or Benjamin. Benjamin is only about 10 miles wide north-south at its widest point. So they could easily have gone all the way through Benjamin into Judah. They could have alerted some thousands within that region in a matter of minutes. Now, to get them gathered together might take a couple hours as they run and gather together. But the sons of Israel went down with him, and he was at their head. What they did was very strategic. Since the forces of Moab were on the west side of the Jordan, they went to the fords of the Jordan and took those. They held the fords so that when the Moabites, who now had no king and were in confusion, as they tried to head for home, the safety of home, they were cut off, and 10,000 of them were killed that day. 10,000 valiant and robust men. Now, is that bragging? These were tough guys. Or is it just saying, this was no trivial feat? You know, there was a serious force there that they defeated that day. As a result of that single decisive battle, they had peace for 80 years. Now, that's a really good run. Any comments or thoughts? Where he went, we have Moab, which was before this, before they had conquered, they were off to the east of the Dead Sea. So they would not have had this blue area to the west side of the Jordan River. They had apparently moved over, and the king and these 10,000 troops, at least, were there somewhere on the west side. In Jericho, maybe not. In the neighborhood, quite possibly, because it was a great place. You know, it was an oasis in the desert, plenty of water, a good, steady water supply, and a nice little green spot. Ehud killed Eglon, and then he took off up to the hill country of Ephraim. Sounded the trumpet, gathered the men, and they went down to the Jordan and took the fords there. And the battle ensued, and they were victorious. Judge number three, Shamgar. He only gets one verse. One verse. Would somebody read 331? Not much to go on, is it? It says, son of Anat. If you recall from our earlier discussions, Anat was, at least the name that we are familiar with, was a goddess of war, portrayed as a young woman who really delighted in bloodshed. She was vicious. Now, killing 600 Philistines, maybe this was a name that was given to him after the event. You know, hey, he is like her. You know, men were not usually named by, according to their mothers. They would be son of their father rather than the son of a mother. And this is a feminine name, and we know this name as the name of a goddess. It's... You know, I don't have anything to back this up as far as scholarly works. It's my suspicion that he was probably given this name as a result of this, you know, performance that he put on there in killing 600 Philistines by himself. Now, was he by himself? I mean, was he just by himself when he did this? Doesn't say. Did he have a force of Israelites that went with him, and they did this, but he happened to have killed 600 by himself? We don't know. Any way you look at it, killing 600 people with an ox goad is quite a feat. An ox goad is a farmer's tool. It's a long pointy stick that's used to guide the oxen. It's not much of a weapon. I found this to try to show an ox goad. So we have the guy with the plow and the other one's got the stick. And it looks like he's got a nail or something in the end of it. And I don't think that's realistic. You look at other things of this image, like the human faces on the oxen. And the fancy clothes that they're wearing out there plowing the field. It looks like they just came out of the king's court. I don't think the artist here ever saw a plow. But the caption up there is, God speed the plow and send us corn and now. You know, give us food. I can't imagine jabbing the cattle. That is not being kind to your beast. But to train them and to use it to guide them, yes. But you know, stabbing them with a nail, I don't think that'd be a good move. Now, the name Shamgar is not Hebrew. The scholars think that it's probably Hurrian. And so the Hurrians are from this area up to the quite a bit to the north around Asia Minor. They are a people that had a language that is still not understood. And they had a society that was built around the chariot warrior. And this is all I can get out of Google or Wikipedia. They were there for a while. They had this dynasty of the Mitanni kings. And in a little while, they were defeated and absorbed by the Hittites and the Assyrians. And just, they disappeared from history. But that's where they think he came from, or possibly of those peoples. Which would be kind of ironic that you have this outsider who is used to judge Israel. Let's look at some comparisons of these three judges. The term judged was used with Othniel, but it was not used with Ehud or Shamgar. It seems pretty obvious, though, that Ehud would have been judging since he had that 80-year period of peace. We're not told more, but that term is not used. And in the one verse that Shamgar gets, it's definitely not in there. The methods that they used. Othniel led a military force out to defeat Kushan Rishathaim. He had apparently been an established leader, and he took them out. They did sort of conventional war and beat them. Ehud started out apparently as a solo idea. He had a plan when he went, obviously, because he had made this sword and concealed it. He had an idea, but there's nothing suggesting that he told anybody else. Now, would he have told anybody else? He might not have. In fact, if you tell somebody else and they get scared and go tell the king, well, that kills the plan and it kills the planner. So it seems that he probably had this plan and he just did it. And when he succeeded at the first step, he went to the second step of going and mustering the people and going and defeating the Moabites in general. Shamgar, was it a solo effort? We don't know. Was it him like Samson with his jawbone of an ass killing 1,000 men? Was he out there just by himself with this stick and killing 600 men? Or was it part of a battle where there were others involved? It doesn't tell us. And there's no period of peace mentioned with Shamgar either. He seems to kind of sit in there probably within that 80-year period that was following Ehud. Next week we get only one, Deborah. She's unique. First, she's a woman. She is the only female judge of Israel. Where some of the others had various less than exemplary things about them, she is held up to be quite different. She was a prophetess and a judge. So we'll do that next week. So chapters 4 and 5 for next week, read them, study, get ready for the pop quiz. Any comments? We have about 2 minutes. James. Thank you. My hope is that we can think about things and think about what was probably going on, but I don't want to add to or take away anything. Jim. That's a real good point. Did you all hear that? Yes, no? Okay. Some of the people that I listen to, they talk about Shamgar. He's got an ox goad. This is not a very effective weapon. And they say one of the lessons you can learn from that is whatever you've got, God can use. So you don't have to have, a tank. You don't have to be the smartest person out there. You don't have to be the one that studied the most. Just go and use what you've got. Thank you for your attention.